$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
It's Valentine's Day. You can show love to your mom, your lover, or yourself while supporting WBAI. If you call 212-209-2950 to order flowers, your New York City recipient will receive an arrangement of premium, long-stemmed Ecuadorian Explorer red roses, accented with fragrant eucalyptus and housed in a glass vase. And a portion of your order supports WBAI. To order our Valentine's Day Floral Premium, call 212-209-2950 by the 7th for your true love and for WBAI.
This is Phil Donahue, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, from our virtual reading series, Lara Elena Donnelly reads from her brand new novel, Base Notes, after which she is in discussion with writer Barbara Krasnov. Also, Dan Persons reviews some of the latest in genre cinema. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Before we begin the main part of the program, I thought it would be fun to play an old-time radio drama of a story by William Tenn and share an anecdote about him. I only met him once, but he was a funny, genial, short guy, very Jewish. And when he worked at the University of Pennsylvania in the English department, and by the way, I should mention that the name Philip Klass, K-L-A-S-S, he is not related at all to the ufologist. This is a person who did science fiction, not related fantasy. So anyway, the English department had a tradition of every month inviting a writer as a dinner guest. And Phil Klass was astonished to learn that the guest that coming month was William Tenn. He didn't say anything to anybody. A couple of people in the department knew that Philip Klass wrote as William Tenn, but this is in the days when science fiction was in no way, shape, or form respectable, so it was kept a little bit on the QT. So come the event, in comes this guy, cardigan, sweater, pipe in hand, handsome, tall, genial, funny, witty. And everybody thought, wow, this William Tenn guy is great. And he knew everything that William Tenn had ever written. He was an expert on all writings and things William Tenn, except perhaps identity. And later on, one of his friends asked him, Phil, why didn't you out this guy? Why didn't you say, forsooth, I am the real William Tenn? And Klass said, he was so perfect. He was exactly who I want William Tenn to be. So, let him continue. Having said that, here's an episode of Dimension X.
Adventures in Time and Space. Transcribed in Future Tense.
Dimension
The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, bring you Dimension X. In these times, even a child knows the meaning of atomic fission, jet propulsion, and electronic transmission. What, we ask ourselves, will the child of the future know? What of the time when science unlocks the secret of life itself? Could it be that one day, such things as constructing human life or passing back and forth from one dimension to another will become mere child's play?
My name is Sam Weber. I'm an attorney, and a pretty successful one, if I do say so myself. My wife, Tina, and I live in a comfortable 12-room place up in Westchester. Now, I've read a lot of Horatio Alger stuff in my time, and so have you probably, but I'll bet you've never heard anything quite as spectacular as my story. Maybe you won't believe it, but I used to be a completely different guy. Frightened, sickly, nearsighted, a real Mortimer Meek. No kidding. That was 5 years ago. The big change in me began to take place on a cold December morning in 1945.
Just a moment, please. Yes, please.
Weber?
Yes.
Samuel?
That's right.
Step back. Okay, fellas, bring it in.
Oh, just a moment. You must have the wrong address.
Watch it, buddy. All right, sign here.
Is that for me?
Weber Apartments.
Looks like a coffin.
I don't design them, Jack. I just deliver them. Sign here.
After much straining, I wasn't in very good physical shape those days, I managed to push the box under my single light bulb. There was a card in a small envelope.
Let's see. To Sam from your classmates at the Interdimensional and Cosmic Institute. Merry Christmas. 2145 A.D. Holy jumping catfish. Hey, mister, there must be some mistake. Hey! Holy jumping catfish.
They were gone, and I didn't even know which delivery company it was. Well, I finally decided to open it up and see what was in it. After about a half hour of fumbling, I gave up.
All right, then, don't open.
No sooner had I said the word open than it came apart like the skin off a banana. There inside was something resembling a kid's chemical set. Vials, jars, tubes, wires. You never saw so much scientific-looking junk in your life. And on top of it all was a book of instructions.
Build a man set number 3. This set is intended solely for uses of children between the ages of 11 and 13. The equipment will enable the child to build and assemble complete adult humans in perfect working order. A disassembler is provided so the set may be used over again. Refills and additional parts may be acquired from the Build-A-Man Company, 928 Diagonal Level, Blunt City, Ohio. Remember, only with Build-A-Man can you build a man.
When I left for work that morning, my brain was still reeling with the stuff I'd read in the instruction book.
Someone says no, Jack. Attorneys at law. Just a moment, I will connect you with Mr. O'Jack. Oh, good morning, Mr. Weber.
Good neuron. I mean, good morning. I've got to get my mind off that book.
Only with Build a Man can you build a man. Chapter 1, Making Simple Living Things. Chapter 2, Duplicating Babies and Other Small Humans.
Oh, no. I've got to get a grip on myself. Here, do a little work. O'Brien versus O'Brien. Martin versus the City of New York. Oh, it must have been a dream. Probably go home tonight and find the place empty.
Well, 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 if it isn't a poor man's Clarence Darrow.
Oh, hello, Lou.
I come as a bearer of sad tidings.
Well, you don't look very sad.
The boss wants to see you, laughing boy.
What about?
How should I know? Oh, and by the way, you'll be very happy to know that I've just been promoted. I'm handling all the criminal stuff from now on.
Congratulations.
You know what this means for Tina and me, don't you, Junior? Oh, well, cheer up. Tina's not for you anyway. Some got it, some don't. I got it, you don't. So long, laughing boy.
That was my good friend, Lou White. In the year I'd known him, he'd already managed to steal a job I wanted, and he was now working on the girl I wanted. Her name was Tina. Tina Velvet.
Good morning, Sam.
Oh, good morning, Tina. My, you look good enough to...
Yeah?
Take to lunch.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sam, but I promised Lou.
Oh, sure.
I hope you're not too disappointed.
Me? Oh, no, no. Some got it, some don't. I don't.
And that was Tina. I tried to steady my blood pressure as I walked into the boss's office.
You sent for me, Mr. Rojak?
Oh, yes. Sit down, Weber. Sit down.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Rojak.
Weber, I've been reviewing the work of my staff counselors for the past 6 months. I want to know only one thing.
Yes, sir?
What happened?
I don't understand.
You haven't had a single new client in 6 months.
But no one has come in, Mr. Rojak.
My boy, in this business, you've got to be aggressive. You've got to go out and create new clients. You've got to show some zip.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any zip?
Oh, yes. Yes, Mr. Rojak. Oh, I've got zip, all right. I just can't seem to turn it loose, that's
well,
all.
Well, get in there and punch now, Weber. I want to see a change in you in the next few months. As a matter of fact, I'd better. You got that?
Yes, Mr. Rojak. I'll try to
Show some zip.
I left the office early and went home. Sure enough, there it was, my Build a Man set, gleaming a little obscenely in the corner. I walked over to it, gave it a kick, and hollered,
"Open sesame."
3 minutes later, I was flopped down in bed reading
Chapter 1, Making Simple Living Things.
An hour later, I was fooling around with such complicated items as the Junior Biocalibrator, which measured everything from blood pressure to hemoglobin content, and the Jiffy Vitalizer, which was actually supposed to put life in your creation, providing you had followed instructions carefully. At 8:30, I made my first simple living thing.
Here, boy. Here, boy. Oh, maybe you aren't a boy. Well, let's see. According to the book, you are a rubicular oyster hog. Not much to look at, but I made you. Me, Sam Weber, attorney at law. I have created life. Hey, come back here. Come back. Here, boy. Here, boy. Hey, hey, hey.
It was no use. My rubicular oyster hog, which was a cross between a field mouse and an oyster, had run out under the door and into the world. I was about to take off after it when there was a knock on my door. It was Mrs. LaPanty, my landlady.
Oh, hello, Mrs. LaPanty.
I heard a noise.
Oh, just rehearsing a speech I have to make in court.
You were squeaking.
A bad throat.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, there was a gentleman looking for you this afternoon.
A gentleman?
Yeah, a tall old man in a black overcoat. Kind of nasty. Well, I told him he wasn't anyone to go up to your room. Tell you, I showed him the way out in a hurry.
Oh, thanks, Mrs. LaPanty. Probably a bill collector.
Yeah. Well, I gotta run.
Sam, here's that memo on Rosenthal versus Rosenthal, and also a letter for you.
What's the matter? You look tired.
Well, I had a bad night.
Your lumbago again?
Yes.
Oh. Oh, say, by the way, your client was here again this morning.
The client?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it must be the same fella that called at my house the other day.
Yeah.
Well, what did you tell him?
Oh, I said you'd be in later.
Oh, thanks.
Will that be all, Sam?
Yes. Oh, no. Are you doing anything New Year's Eve?
Oh, Sam, you haven't even noticed.
Noticed what?
Well, the ring, silly. Third finger, left hand.
What?
Lou gave it to me. Isn't it simply gigantic?
But you're going to
be married as soon as Lou finishes his next case. Lou is so sharp and businesslike.
So is a guillotine.
Sam, after Lou gave me the ring last night, I began thinking how I used to hope that it would be you. But, well, then I realized you'd never have the money, and, well, a girl has to think of things like a good steady income and a husband with
zip.
Yes, with zip.
Well, Lou has plenty of zip. I'm sure you'll be very happy zipping around with each other.
Oh, Sam.
Well, Sam, Hey, what's going on in here? Honey, is this little baboon giving you any trouble? If he has, I'll take him apart like an egg crate.
No. Take it easy, Strongheart. Tina just told me the good news about your engagement. She's crying with happiness.
Is that right, honey? Well, then, no hard feelings, Sam. Just that the best man got the girl, you understand. Oh, say, by the way, we're having a little celebration at Sigali's tonight. Drop in and we'll live it up a little, huh?
I went home feeling like a man who has been stuffed into a washing machine with the dial set at rinse dry. I was a failure. I walked over to the mirror for a heart-to-heart talk with myself.
Nothing. That's what you've got, Sam Weber, in unlimited quantities. Nothing. We ought to just tear you down and start all over again. We ought to take you... pay. Oh, no. No, not that again. But why not? Think of it. A Sam Weber without the psychological problems you've got. A dynamic, uninhibited Sam who could win a girl like Tina by sheer magnetism. Then when it was all over, we could just take the old disassembler and presto. And I can do it, too. Chromosome content, check. Cerebral content. Maybe a little more id and a little less superego. Limbs, eyes, hair, general endocrine reaction. Well, here goes. It's moving. Holy mackerel, it's alive. It's getting up.
Say, I feel great.
Well, now, take it easy. Do you know who you are?
Of course I do. I have all the thoughts you ever had up until the point I was vitalized. My brain is an exact duplicate of yours, except that I'm not all blocked up psychologically.
Right. It said in the instruction manual you'd be uninhibited.
Say, this is all right. Oh, by the way, since we both have the same name, it'll simplify things if I call you Weber. I'll be Sam.
Oh, now look here. I'll make the decision.
How would you like a good punch in the nose?
Well, is that any way to talk to your own parent? I did create you, you know.
Well, don't think I don't appreciate it, Weber, old man, but let's get one thing straight. I live my life and you live yours. You got that?
Who pays the rent?
You do, for a while anyway. I haven't decided whether or not I want to stay in the law business.
The law business?
I may want to spread out a little. Tina's the kind of girl to whom money is very important.
Tina?
Well, what did you expect? I have enough of your likes and dislikes to want her just as badly as you do. The only difference being that I can get her. No, we're not quite the same, you and I. I've got zip.
Don't use that word.
Now, how about some dinner? You know, I'm starved.
I'll have to go out.
I'll need some clothes.
Sorry, I only have this one suit.
Fine, you can lend it to me.
Well, what about me?
I'll bring you a sandwich after I come back from Sagalli's.
Sagalli's?
Well, you haven't forgotten, have you, Weber? We're invited to the celebration. Tina and Lou White. Only it wouldn't look quite right if we both showed up, so I'll tell you all about it. Now, off with that suit. And no nonsense.
Well, this is living it up, folks. Yahoo! Have another drink, Mr. Old Jack.
Thank you, Lou.
Well, is everybody happy?
Hey, honey, are you having yourself a little old time?
Oh, yes, Lou, fine.
Yeah, but you seem to be preoccupied.
Oh, I was just wondering if Sam is coming.
Sam? Oh, no. Did you hear that, Mr. Rojack? She's worrying about Sam. Why, that little runt probably got frightened by a noisemaker.
Well, the happy couple.
Sam!
Good evening, cats. Everybody's lit up like a Christmas tree.
Well, I'll be... Say, Sam, are you in the bag?
Never touch the stuff, Luma boy. Never touch it. Boy Scout training.
Oh, Sam, I was afraid you weren't coming.
Miss a chance to be with you, beautiful? Never.
Hey, what's got into you, Weber? Monkey glands?
I don't read you, muscle bound.
Well, you seem different somehow, even your voice.
Do you notice anything, Tina?
Well, yes, it does seem richer somehow.
Oh, nonsense. Sam Weber, you're nothing but a cream puff, and you always will be.
Mr. Ojack, I think he owes me an apology for that.
I should think so.
All right, all-American boy, make with the apology.
Apologize me? Oh, no. Why, for 2 cents?
Folks, would you excuse Mr. White and me for a few minutes? We want to step out into the hall for a little private conference. Coming, Mr. White?
I'll be right back, honey. Don't worry about a thing.
Okay, big boy, you've taken enough punishment. Now.
Sam! Lou, don't kill him. He did... Oh, dear.
He'll be all right in a little while, baby.
But did you... I mean... Oh, Sam.
Tina.
We really shouldn't kiss like this.
It's what you've always wanted, isn't it? Well, isn't it?
Oh, Sam.
By this time, he's probably kissing her. And there's nothing you can do about it, Weber, old man. Nothing. Hey, wait a minute. Where's that book of instructions? To disassemble a Build-A-Man model, merely focus the ray of the disassembler device and press lever X. But that's murder, Counselor. Still, legally, in order to prove there's been a murder, you need a corpus delicti. And nobody even knows there is another Sam Weber. Oh, so you're finally home. I'm starved.
Sorry, Weber, old man, but very pressing business detained me.
I suppose you made a fool of me over at Sigali's.
Oh, on the contrary.
What do you mean?
My boy, you were looking at a man who in one fell swoop has got himself a raise, a promotion, and a wife. At least she'll be my wife tomorrow.
Who?
Tina, of course.
I don't believe
it. I had to put on quite a show, but all around it was a real success. Mr. Ojak was so impressed, he called me aside and said he was going to give me a crack at some criminal cases. And if I made the grade, why, who knows, I may even accept a partnership.
You've got it all figured out, haven't you?
That's about it.
Only you neglected to consider one thing.
Oh, what's that?
This.
Hey, put that down.
Get back, you. You usurper, you. I'm going to melt you down like a Welsh rarebit.
Weber, you can't do that. It's murder. It's like killing your own son.
After what you've done to me, it's a pleasure.
I didn't ask to be brought into this world, but now that I'm here, I like it enough to want to survive.
Take off my suit, you phony. You won't be needing it again.
You're really going through with it, huh?
I am.
All right. Oh, here's your jacket. Give me that thing. Give it to me. That's better. Now, we'll fix this little item so it can't do any damage.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you see, Weber? You don't have the guts to stand up against the man you might have been.
Oh, what's that sound?
I don't know.
It seems to be inside the house.
Somebody's coming up the stairs. Listen. Take a peek through the keyhole, Weber.
Yeah. Oh, he's jumping. It's him.
Oh.
The old man with the black coat, his eyes all black and shiny without any whites. Looks insane.
Don't open it.
Hey, he's burning it. He's burning a hole right through the door.
Good evening, gentlemen. As I feared, I'm too late to prevent you from duplication, Mr. Weber. And I see that you have destroyed the disassemblator. That means I shall have to do the job manually. An ugly task.
Well, who are you?
I am the census keeper for the 24th Oblong. You see, your Build-A-Man set was intended for one of the Weber children who is on a field trip in this Oblong 200 years from now. Because of an unfortunate time warp, the set was delivered here accidentally.
You mean this set came here from 200 years from now?
Precisely. Time, as with all things, is relative. We shall have to recover the set, of course, and adjust any discrepancies it has caused. But meanwhile, the problem is, which of you two gentlemen is the original Sam Weber?
Oh, I am. Listen,
difficulties, difficulties. Why cannot I ever have a simple case like a double canuplication?
Now, look here, Mr. Census Keeper. The duplicate will obviously be
less stable and more emotionally unbalanced. Certainly, a man of your qualifications can decide which of us is the more valid member of society. Which of us will conform more readily to the standards.
Naturally. I observe that one of you is naked.
Oh, wait a minute.
And you also seem to be trembling. Whereas this gentleman seems quite calm.
No, hold it. You're making a mistake.
I hardly think so.
Then I'll stay away
please
from you.
Please do not struggle.
Help, please, please.
Mr. Weber.
Yes.
It would be better if you didn't watch.
Of course. Well, that's my story. Within 10 seconds, the old Sam Weber had been completely dismantled and packed into the box. Tina and I were married, and I went on to become a full partner in the firm of Ojak, Somerset, and Weber.
Oh, and by the way, Tina and I have been doing quite successfully what the old Sam Weber and his Build a Man set made such a mess of. We have 1, 2, 3 little conjugations. Sam Jr., age 4, Sametta, age 3, and Samina, age 4 months. Good night.
You have just heard another adventure into the unknown world of the future. The world of...
Dimension X.
Time is a strange and mysterious dimension. Could we alter the future if we could travel back in time to our own youth? Next week, we bring you a story of a man who found the answer in Time and Time Again.
Dimension X is presented, transcribed each week by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of the magazine Astounding Science Fiction. Today, Dimension X is presented Child's Play, written for radio by George Lefferts from the story by William Tenn. Featured in the cast were Leon Janney as Sam, Carl Weber as his alter ego, and Patsy Campbell as his girl. Your host was Norman Rose, music by Bert Berman. Dimension X is produced by William Welch and directed by Fred Way.
In reply to many queries from our listeners, last week's story on Dimension X, Pebble in the Sky, was written by Isaac Asimov. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
No, this is not the National Broadcasting Company. This is, in fact, WBAI in New York City and WBAI.org. And that was, of course, an episode of Dimension X. We're backed up on reviews from Dan Persons, so we're going to hear one now and another one later on.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. In the new German film Sleep, which has just had a Blu-ray release and is probably available in other formats as well, a woman, Marlena, played by Sandra Hurler, is haunted by dreams of a hotel where 3 men have killed themselves and a 4th has survived. When she arrives at the hotel, located in a small town, she suffers some kind of seizure, winding up conscious but unresponsive in a hospital. Her daughter, Mona, played by Groß von Ihr Kohlhoff, is summoned to Marlena's bedside and checks into the hotel, in whose somewhat tacky environs the daughter finds herself oscillating between the attentions of the maybe too solicitous staff, dreamlike visions of the 3 suicides, and the presence of a mysterious woman named Trude. Truth in reporting, I had to resort to the supplemental materials on the Sleep Blu-ray in order to connect the dots of what's actually happening in the hotel and how it connects to Marlena and Mona. I don't think it's really a fault in the storytelling. I missed a certain key detail about Marlena's history at the beginning of the film and didn't recognize a certain character in a later dream sequence. Even with that confusion, I liked the way director Michael Venus kept pulling the rug out from under his scenario, which he co-wrote. He creates doubt about where we are in the waking world, whether what we're seeing is supposed to be objective reality or dreams within dreams within dreams. Very often, the states will shift from one to the other without any definitive separating line. Even more interesting is how Venus uses the haunting nature of dreams to reflect on how the past haunts us as well, both personal and historical. And yes, I'm talking about that specific bit of German history. The promotional materials for Sleep compare it to David Lynch. Normally, I look askance at such comparisons because they generally just serve as a stand-in for saying weird stuff goes on. But here, the comparison is apt, both for the ambiguity between reality and fantasy, and for a certain edge that leavens the darkness. Parallels to Twin Peaks are obvious, although I don't recall Twin Peaks ever featuring a dinner banquet devolving into a Nazi rally. Opaque as sleep can sometimes get, and again that may have been my fault, it's still a unique and compelling experience. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Last Tuesday, as a part of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, our guest was Lara Elena Donnelly. And, you know, unfortunately now, during the pandemic, we have to do these on a virtual basis instead of actually meeting at 388 Atlantic Avenue, which is coincidentally the same building as WBAI. Whether or not we're going to be able to continue in that space is something I'm going to have to learn. But first, we have to wait for this plague to be over. So online, Lara was talking about her new book, Base Notes, with Barbara Krasnoff. And then we will have a reading, followed by another review, followed by an interview. Stay tuned.
Greetings, and welcome to the Yursif Readings. Welcome to everybody and to those who celebrated a very happy Lunar New Year and Year of the Tiger. Tonight we are going to have Lara Elena Donnelly, the author of the Nebula, Lambda, and Locust nominated trilogy, The Ambolo Dossier, and the author of a brand new novel called Base Notes. But before I bring her on, well, actually, we don't have very many announcements tonight. Yursif is, for the present, remaining virtual, although we hope to change that as soon as it's practical. We will be here monthly, usually on the first Tuesday of every month, although that can change now and again. And we will be accessible both on Facebook and on Jim Freund's YouTube channel. So I hope that we have people watching on both venues. And it will be also available after the fact. And while we miss meeting you all in person, and I really do miss saying hi to you all, the advantage is that we can present authors who are not in the New York City area. And we will announce our next guest as soon as possible. So let's go right into it. Lara Elaine Donnelly is the author of the Nebula, Lambda, and Locust nominated trilogy, The Ambolo Dossier, as well as short fiction and poetry appearing in venues including Strange Horizons, Escape Pod, Nightmare, and Uncanny. She has taught in the MFA program at Sarah Lawrence College, as well as the Catapult Workshop in New York. She is a graduate of the Clarion and Alpha Writers Workshop and has served as on-site staff at the latter, mentoring some amazing teens who will someday take over the world of science fiction and fantasy. Lara's new novel is Base Notes, in which a 20-something perfumer named Vic Fowler has built a deadly side hustle to cope with the crushing demands of late capitalism. And now I'd like to introduce Lara Elena Donnelly. Hey there.
Hello. It's such a pleasure to be here, even virtually. I am in the New York area, and I miss coming to the Yursif Readings in person. But I am so happy to see at least your face, if not the faces of all of the viewers.
And hopefully our viewers will say hello on their various chat channels and maybe ask a few questions later. But first, tell us a little bit about Base Notes.
Oh, man. Okay, so Base Notes, I feel, was summed up pretty well in the whole, like, 20-something perfumer cultivates a deadly side hustle to, you know, deal with the demands of late capitalism. That is pretty much what it is. But it's also kind of, not exactly a love letter, but definitely a sort of homage to the struggle of trying to pursue your art while trying to make ends meet. It really focuses on that sort of dynamism between I'm trying to make sure I can pay rent and eat, and like afford to clothe myself and see the doctor, but also the thing that I really care about won't give me any of those things. You know, it won't get me health insurance. It won't pay my rent, but it matters more than anything else. And trying to balance those two opposing facets of the life of an artist, particularly in New York City where it's so expensive, but I think probably everywhere.
Yeah, I know. I remember at one point, Vic talks about how it's almost impossible to do your art unless you either inherit money or make a good, great deal of money doing something else. And I was sitting there going, oh yeah.
Yeah, I remember there's this in-flight magazine article that my partner and I joke about a lot that was like, you know, it was about artists living in Nashville, I think. Like there was a neon sign artist and like someone who did, you know, lino cut prints or whatever. It was like a whole bunch of artist profiles, and every single one of them, and this is all in the like Visit Nashville tourist section, and we're like waiting to take off, but every single one of these artists was like left their fast-paced tech job or like sold all their stock options and moved to Nashville to become a neon sign artist. And so we joke all the time about like, oh yeah, left the fast-paced world of whatever behind to pursue my art.
What I also liked about your characters is each one has a different type of art, something that some of the readers might not see as art. For example, one of the characters is a barber, but he's very, very good at what he does. It's his art, and I really like that art isn't necessarily just writing or sculpture or something like that. It can be one of many different things. It's just whatever your passion is.
Yeah, and it's basically about skill that's undervalued in this economy, right? So like there's the more traditional artist characters like Vic, who is a perfumer, and Bo, who is a bespoke tailor. So both of those I think you can sort of cast as an art. But then there's Giovanni, who's a barber, and Jane, who's a bartender. She previously was a photographer, but she's sort of given that up to try to pursue jobs that will make her more money. So she's putting herself through technical school to become a radiology tech. She's putting herself through school by being a bartender. But I think that stuff like, you know, being a barber or being a bartender is like it's a skill. The people who do those jobs really well are artisans or craftsmen. Like they've perfected this very technical manual skill, and it's not valued in the same way that, like, I don't know, being a front-end developer or something. Like you're not going to make six figures cutting hair, probably, but the people who make six figures are going to come to you and be like, cut my hair, you're the best.
Yeah, right.
Here's a $10 tip.
Well, going back to one of those arts is your main character, who is a perfumer. That must have taken a huge amount of research.
It did, but I don't want to say that it took any more research than anything else that a book would be about. And when you get into the mode of writing, you know, this big of a project, I think the research becomes almost part and parcel of the writing project, and less of a like, I must go to the library now and check out all of the books about perfume. It becomes much more like all consuming and also sort of integrated into the work. So I did do a lot of reading before I started drafting or in between drafts, but then I was also just doing sort of catch as catch can. Like if I needed to know something while I was writing, I'd go on a Google hole and end up on some weird forum where people were talking about like, well, what if I want to tincture something at home? Like, am I going to blow up my house if I try to use a still in my basement? And people were like, don't use a still in your basement. Take it outside. Unless it's a small tabletop still, then it's okay. So I like people ask me what kind of research I did. And I'm like, well, I read, there are like a couple of books I read, all of which have, of course, deserted me now that we are, you know, on a live broadcast. Like, have I ever read a book in my entire life? Nope, doesn't check out. But I think a lot of it was just like, oh, I need to know a thing. Where can I find that information? And I also was really, really lucky to be able to talk to a couple of niche perfumers who like run their own indie houses. So I was able to talk with Chris Rusak, who runs a house called Chris Rusak, and Carter Weeks-Maddox, who runs Chronotope. And they were both really helpful when I had like questions about the business or questions about the technical side. Chris even read a couple of scenes for me where I was like, I really don't know if I've done this right. And he's a very busy man. So I was very, very, very grateful for him to take the time. But that was definitely a big stroke of luck, was having real people that I could ask very specific questions of.
Now Base Notes is very different than your previous novels. How did you get into it? Why did you decide to do this particular subject matter, as it were?
I've seen a couple of people be like, wow, this is nothing like the Amber Lowe dossier. And I can totally understand that. It is very different. But I think it deals with some of the same things. Like, it's definitely about class difference. Like, there are some people who have a lot of money and there are some people who don't. It's definitely about my undying desire to write about beautiful stuff like perfume and clothes and food. There's a lot of food in all of my stuff. But it is really different tonally. And the setting is very different. And what inspired me to write about it actually is that I had read an article by Jude Doyle in The Guardian called My Search for the Great American Perfume, that was about how most American perfumes are very squeaky clean. Like, they make you smell a little like you've sprayed laundry detergent all over yourself. Americans don't want to smell sweaty or dirty or like they inhabit a human body. Whereas like great European perfumes have these very sort of bodily base notes. And I read this and I started getting very into perfume. And a couple of months later, I was asked to participate in an anthology that was themed around the color orange for my Clarion class, actually. So the Clarion UCSD Writers Workshop, we were doing a fundraising anthology. We did like the whole rainbow. So that year was orange. And one of the things that this article had talked about was orange blossom as a note that shows up a lot in American perfumes because it smells really clean. And I was like, oh, orange blossom. I've been thinking about perfume a lot. And so I wrote this short story called The Dirty American, which was reprinted later in Nightmare Magazine. So if people want to check it out, it's still online. And then years went by. I was finishing up the Amber Lowe dossier. It was finally all done. I had all the books. The last book was turned in and my agent said, what do you want to work on now? And I had a couple of ideas, the least well-formed of which was like this one sentence where I was like, oh, I could turn this short story into a novel. Maybe seems cool. And I had been living in New York for a while at that point. So like when I first wrote the story, it was literally the first week that I moved to New York City. Oh. I wrote this story, The Dirty American. And it takes place in New York. And then a couple years later, maybe like 5 years later, but definitely several years later, I was supposed to be writing my fourth novel. And I thought I could turn this short story into a novel. And I had been living in the city long enough that I like to think I had a better handle on what it was like to be broke living in New York. And I think the setting is much better informed. So I don't know if that answered the question at all. That's how I ended up writing this book.
No, I don't think you make any kind of secret about the fact that your protagonist is an interesting person who does really awful things. And that's, you know, that is something that we're aware of in the beginning, so it's not like I'm giving away any spoilers. How do you write, on the one hand, a protagonist who you know is doing these things, and on the other hand, it's somebody who you're interested in and almost can get into the head of?
I don't know. I really like awful people. Like, I love Patricia Highsmith, right? Like, I devoured the Ripley books, like, while I was writing this, actually. A couple people had recommended to me, like, oh, you really need to read The Talented Mr. Ripley. And I hadn't done it. Sort of like people had told me you have to read Patrick Süskind's Perfume, The Story of a Murderer. which I only read while I was drafting the short story, The Dirty American. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'd better know what this is about while I'm writing this. So while I was writing Base Notes, I was like, okay, I'll guess I'll read the Ripley novels. I just love characters who make really bad choices. Maybe because there's something fun about, you know, like, it's not just the murder, like the murder aspect of this. Vic is also just an awful person, like loves to be mean, always has a cruel aside about someone else, very judgmental, extremely catty. And I think there's something really fun, both consuming media and creating it, where you can kind of be like, this is what I would have said if I were a worse person. I would have been like, oh, like nice coat, you know?
Yeah, not really.
I can't even do it in real life. I can only do it when I'm writing and I'm like, a terrible insult, a brutal murder.
Well, Vic is, to me, I mean, when I first started reading it, they were very, the type, I know people like that. I mean, I'm presuming they're not murderers, but.
And maybe you need to, like, re-examine your friend choices.
But, no, I have met through my life people like that, very, very catty, very superior, you know, loves to gossip, loves to, loves the best things in life, even though they can't afford it, that kind of thing. So this is a very familiar type of person.
But I think that not being able to afford things kind of breeds, like when you can see what you want and you can't get it, I think it kind of breeds a little bit of that, you know, claws out.
Absolutely. Especially if you are trying to look like you can afford it, even though you can't. That can lead into a lot of problems.
Because then there's the anxiety. You're like, everyone's going to know. They're going to find out. And they're never allowed.
Exactly. And what can I do to keep them from coming out? And that starts the dominoes falling. How would you classify this novel? Or how would you classify it? It's not urban fantasy. It's not horror. But it's a little bit of both. How would you classify this?
So it's been marketed as a thriller, and I think that's kind of right, but I don't think it's exactly, like, I think when people think of thrillers, they think of, when I think of thrillers, I think of, like, Patricia Highsmith, to some extent, like, not exactly Shirley Jackson, but, like, kind of dark, gothic, like, twisted, very like psychological interpersonal kind of horror. And I think that now when we talk about like the contemporary thriller, it's much more of a sort of a cross of action and mystery. So this is definitely like a thriller in the dark psychological interpersonal horror vein of the thriller. But it also, I think, has some crossover to like dark fantasy, and maybe some crossover to like dark academia. There's no academia in it, but it has really similar vibes to a lot of dark academia, or like a certain vein of mainstream literary fiction that's very about backstabbing and striving.
Well, I have a few other questions, but I think first we probably can't do better than to hear something from the novel.
Oh boy. Okay. Let me get all set up. I have my little bookmark in here. I'm going to read, it's not exactly very the beginning. I thought about reading the opening scene, which you mentioned earlier, really dumps you right in the mess. But instead, I'm going to start with Vic is meeting with a former client, so someone who has hired Vic to make the special murder perfume at least once before, and then sort of has teased that he might be interested in making an investment in the business, which is really struggling. So Vic runs a niche perfumery called Bright House, and Eisner has said, oh, I you know, have a ton of money. I am a wealthy person involved in finance. Like, I could make an investment in your business. to help you boost production, to get your feet back under you. And he has been avoiding Vic ever since making this promise. He's been like, I won't take your calls. So Vic has finally tracked him down, and they're going to meet up at a performance of Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov at the New York Philharmonic. Eisner texted to say he was running late, trapped in the office, wouldn't make the first half. So I listened to a series of increasingly elaborate and ethereal Berlioz art songs on my own, wondering what he wanted. I looked forward to intermission with equal parts dread and intrigue. About halfway through the interval, I spotted Eisner in the lobby, a miracle in the milling crowd of Q-tips and successful young professionals, salted with student rush and last-minute bargains, Gold Bond, Bad Breath, Bath and Body Works. What did they think when they saw us, I wondered. My best guess was father and child. I kept a careful distance from Eisner's side as we ascended toward the mezzanine. I didn't want to be this evening's grave-robbing arm candy, even in the minds of strangers. It was a surprise to see you at the Dvorak earlier this week, he said. He motioned me through the double doors ahead of him. I suppose you don't seem like the kind of young person who enjoys these things. I wanted to say, you have no idea what kind of young person enjoys these things. Every young person you've ever invited has been trying to impress you, or at least get you to pay for dinner. I wanted to say, you don't know me at all. But I wanted him to pay for my dinner, too, or at least a drink. I wanted him to pay for my life's work. Our seats were very good, nestled in the belly of the center orchestra, with just enough elevation to look slightly down on the stage. The musicians rustled and shifted, ran through scales. I smelled cork grease and key oil. We didn't have to wait long until the conductor appeared in a rain of applause, stepped up, and cued the oboe for a long, clear, tuning note. The oboe doesn't tune to the orchestra, one of my paramours had told me. The orchestra tunes to the oboe. She abided in my leather box now, alongside Jonathan. She had not been a particularly interesting person. Beautiful, yes, and very talented, but it was no sacrifice for me to lose her presence in order to preserve her music in a bottle. Many of my independent pursuits arose when I became involved with people who had a single attribute that captivated, or with whom I had shared one moment of the sublime and several others of the deeply unpleasant. She was one of these latter, better recalled only in flashes for the talents she possessed. No lost potential there. Not to say there hadn't been, with others. If I wanted, when I got home, I could listen to her play Mozart, the two of us alone in the submarine gloom of her ground floor apartment in South Slope, all the windows facing the courtyard. The boiler just beneath the floor filled the rooms with a low hum like the engine of a ship. Mildew, lavender, hot metal, spit, and her own smell, unique, inimitable. I could almost conjure them now, but I knew my remembrance, unaided by the true accord, was fallible. Memory is treacherous territory. My sense are maps, guides, pathways, landmarks that will bring you safely to your intended destination. Silence fell in the concert hall. Several hundred breaths drew in. The baton came down, and the brass exploded. How can I describe this symphony to someone who has never heard it? I cannot hope to do it justice if you are unfamiliar with the piece, and even then, to hear it performed live by the Philharmonic is another matter. The music painted, it danced, it inhaled and exhaled and wove a narrative just beyond language, just beyond the veil of comprehension. It moved so lightly from bombast to lullaby that I felt dizzy. And in the end, when all that was left was a single violin singing over the final chords, I felt my soul strain at the bounds of my body as though it would break through my ribs and follow that sound wherever notes went when they died. Applause did not explode immediately. The audience was stunned. But once it had begun, it would not end. It was like another movement, its dynamics rising and falling, as if this paean too had been penned by Rimsky-Korsakov. What would it take? asked Eisner in the aftermath, eyes half shut. To preserve that sound forever. Just that single note, that moment in the dark. Not forever, I said. Only as long as the perfume lasts, as long as it remains unspoiled and doesn't oxidize. He sighed, waved a hand. You know what I mean. Could you bottle it for me? The last notes of tonight's Scheherazade. What would it take? I looked around David Geffen Hall, the crowd already streaming out. Bright lights, warm wood, the strange geometric shapes of dampeners. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath, conjuring not the image but its outlines in the air, the way the currents of scent eddied around them. Warm wood, still, baked by the stage lights. Hot dust. Rain carried in the clothes and the shoes of the audience, present in the draft from out of doors. Menthol from 100 unwrapped cough drops. Old cigarette smoke, new cigarette smoke, the mingled traces of 1,000 different colognes, perfumes, shampoos. The smell of the audience, the smell of the orchestra. You're not asking about elements, I said. Not about absolutes or the accord. You want to know how many people have to die. He said nothing, only arranged his purple lips into a thin and crooked smile, eyes fixed on something far away. Is that the commission? I asked. Was that why he had brought me here? I've never even tried something like that. It just isn't feasible. A pity, he said, and even I felt cold. But no, I have something more practical in mind. Still a challenge, I think, but one more suited to your talents. Join me for a drink, and I'll explain. We went to a whiskey bar on the Upper West Side. It unnerved me that he knew what I preferred to drink, even more so when he said, "And it's close to your trains, I believe." I doubted Eisner ever took the subway, and the fact he knew enough about my public transit habits to deposit me within easy walking distance of 3 convenient train lines made me leery. I tried to ignore the feeling until I had a heavy tumbler of Kool Isla in hand. I didn't want to tax his generosity too grossly, not at this juncture. Once the notes of pepper and lemon rind had seared my sinuses clean and the booze was settling warmly in my stomach, I finally asked, "What is all this?" Eisner traced the edge of his coaster with one finger, made no eye contact except with a meniscus of his scotch. It's a commission, as I said. But nothing to do with Scheherazade, so why the symphony? He drank, smiling into his glass, but the smile was grim. When he put the whiskey down, he smoothed his hands along the creases in his trousers and said, "Consider that an apology of sorts for, what is it called, for ghosting you? About your investment?" He nodded. "I just need a yes or no, Mr. Eisner. That way I can make my plans." "Unfortunately," he said, "it's a little more complicated than that." Oh, Christ, he was going to be coy. "Don't tell me you're hurting for money." Unease put me on the offensive. "That's a line you'll have a hard time selling." "No," he said, "not that." A worse thought occurred to me. "Is someone on to you about our work together?" "No, thank God." Then sharply, "Why? Have you?" I sipped my scotch first, just to make him sweat. "Not yet." Eisner looked relieved. I was unused to seeing anything on his face besides self-satisfaction. My sense of alarm increased. "So you took me out as an apology," I said. "You can't tell me yes or no, but you still want to hire me for another commission. And you think I'll agree?" "When you hear my terms," he said. All my sphincters twisted tight. This sounded very like an entree to extortion. "Your perfumes," he said, "they let people relive memories, their own memories. But what about memories of moments they never lived? Can you do that?" "Fantasy?" I asked. "Imagination? People can certainly extrapolate from scent, but that's not under my control." He shook his head. "No, real moments, but ones in which we weren't present. For instance, things that happen behind closed doors. I shook my head in turn. This wasn't whatever axe I had expected to fall, which meant that one was likely still suspended. It wouldn't work. As I understand what I do, I barely did. It's based on the way our brains retrieve memory and our associations of particular scents with a moment in the past. If your brain hasn't already built those pathways, I can't trailblaze, as it were. Have you ever tried? He had me there. I covered by drinking. The smell made me think of Jonathan, the bottles on his bar cart, the man who had first served me single malt. How many of the scents I had concocted from his absolute relied on some kind of whiskey note? How many times had I sat across from him with the smells of smoke and malted barley in the air between us before that last night, that last drink? What might he have done in my absence that I would want to know? If Eisner's impossible dream could be made to work, what knowledge could a new memory of Jonathan pass on about this business? But that wasn't how this worked. I couldn't make something out of nothing. Could I? If you can do what I ask, said Eisner, I'll cut a check. Not just for the perfume, but for the sum I offered to help bump production. You'll get your European distribution deal in time for the latter part of the holiday season. You'll be in the black. You'll be safe, or nearly. That invocation of safety didn't sit well with me. And if I refuse... How shocking when they tell me my dead father was made into perfume, sold to me by a twisted sadist, a serial murderer. The scotch had dried the fat from my tongue, and now it sat rough and awkward in my mouth. You wouldn't. I would. Only very occasionally had clients threatened me thus. Most were dissuaded by the idea of mutually assured destruction and by the simple fact that what they had hired me to do could just as easily be done to them. Still, it had happened once or twice, though the stakes had been much lower then. I could not take it on the chin if I dealt with Eisner in the usual gruesome way. He held the future of my business in his hands, rather than a few months' rent. "You're only safe because you're very good at avoiding scrutiny," he said. Once somebody figures out what rocks they should be turning over, then they'll find you down here squirming right beside me. It will come down to hearsay in a court, and I have much better lawyers. And who points to the rocks, Eisner? You won't want to be within 1,000 miles of this. I learned the importance of middlemen long ago. You'd be well served in the future to use a few yourself. The more footprints in the mud, the harder to find the trail you'd like to follow. Too many cooks, I said, tend to ruin the soup. The truth was, I couldn't afford it. He could pay whoever he liked to do whatever he wanted. I couldn't afford a 15% cut, even to cover my ass. I made do with a keen sense of judgment and the occasional threat, which I occasionally made good on. This time, it had not been enough. What if I try and fail? Because I would try. I had to, now. He shrugged. I'm sorry. I only have one contingency plan. I licked my teeth, cleared my throat, and asked him, what's the job?
Okay, you've been listening to part one of last Tuesday's New York Review of Science Fiction Readings event with Lara Elena Donnelly and Barbara Krasnoff.
It's all very well, but what are we going to do about the Italian?
Later on, when it's dark, we'll take him out of the trunk and bury him.
Well, yes, of course, we could do that. I don't suppose he's got any relatives going to come poking around looking for him. Well, you know me. Bright ideas just pop into my head and I keep thinking. Seems a downright shame.
Shame?
Seems an awful waste. Such a nice plump frame. What's his name as? Ad. Has. Nor he can't be traced. Business needs are lipped. Debts to be erased. Think of it as thrift. As a gift. If you get my drift. Now? Waste. I mean, with the price of meat, what it is, when you get it, if you get it.
Ha! Huh.
Good you got it. Take, for instance, Mrs. Mooney and a pie shop. Business never better using only pussycats and toast. And a pussy's good for maybe 6 or 7 at the most. And I'm sure they can't compare as far as taste.
Mrs. Lovett, what a charming notion.
Well,
and a
heavy pack of gold.
You're appropriate as always. Mrs. Lovett, how I've lived without you all these years, I never know.
Think about it. Lots of other gentlemen will soon be cannon for a shame. Won't they?
The sound of the world out there.
What, Mr. Tom? What, Mr. Tom? What is that sound?
Those crunching noises pervading the air.
Yes, Mr. Tom, yes, Mr. Tom, yes, all around.
It's man devouring man, my dear. And who are we to be in here? Ah, these are desperate times, Mrs. Lovett. And desperate measures must be taken.
Here we are now, hot out of the oven.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh. So it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
Now you see, the trouble with poet is, how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Heavenly. Not as hearty as bishop, perhaps, but then not as bland as curate, either.
Good for business, too. Always leaves you wanting more. Trouble is, we only get it on Sundays. Lawyer's rather nice.
If it's for a price...
Order something else, though, to follow, since no one should swallow it twice.
Have you any dean?
No, but if you're British and loyal, you might enjoy Royal Marine. Anyway, it's clean, though of course it tastes of wherever it's been.
Is that squire on the fire?
Mercy no, sir, look closer, you'll notice it grows up.
Looks thicker, more like thicker.
No, it has to be grosser. It's green.
The history of the world, my love.
Save a lot of graves, do a lot of relatives' favors.
Is those below serving those up above?
Everybody shaves, so there should be plenty of flavors.
How gratifying for once to know that those above will serve those down below.
Got a tinker?
No, no. Something pinker.
Tailor.
Paler.
Butler.
Sutler.
Potter.
Hotter.
Locksmith. Lovely bit of clock.
Maybe for a lock.
Then again, the sweep, if you want it cheap and you like it dark. Try the financier. Pick up his career.
That looks pretty rank.
Well, he drank, it's a bank cashier. Last one really sold, wasn't quite so old.
Have you any beetle?
Next week, so I'm told. Beetle isn't bad till you smell it and notice how well it's been greased. Stick to priest. Now, this might be a bit stringy, but then, of course, it's a fiddle player.
No, no. This isn't fiddle player, it's piccolo player.
How can you tell?
It's piping hot.
Then blow on it first.
The history of the world, my sweet.
Oh, Mr. Todd, oh, Mr. Todd, what does it tell?
Is who gets eaten and who gets to eat.
And Mr. Todd, too, Mr. Todd, who gets to sell.
But fortunately, it's all so clear that everybody goes down well with beer.
Since marine doesn't appeal to you, how about rear admiral?
Too salty. I prefer general.
With or without his privates?
Ha, 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 ha.
What is that?
It's fop, finest in the shop. And we have some shepherds pie peppered with actual shepherd on top. And I've just begun. He's a politician so oily, he's served with a doily and one.
Put it on a bun. Well, you never know if it's going to run.
Try the fryer, fry the dryer.
No, the clergy is really too coarse and too mealy. Yes, and always arrives overdone. I'll come again when you have judge on the menu. Have charity towards the world, my pet.
Yes, yes, I know, my love.
We'll take the customers that we can get.
High born and low, my love.
We'll not discriminate great from small. No, we'll serve
We're going to hear an interview with audience questions that were submitted through the Facebook chat channel. But first, we're going to hear another review from Dan Persons.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. You may think you know where the new Japanese film, well, newish. It was actually released in 2009 and is only now getting its U.S. debut in theaters and on demand. But you may think you know where the Japanese film Air Doll is going, but you'd be wrong. Even if you know its director's other works, you still might be wrong. In the film, an inflatable sex doll, Nozomi, played by Bei Duna, suddenly comes to life. During the day, she slips out of her owner's home, wanders the streets of Tokyo, eventually gets a job at a video shop, and falls, maybe, in love with a co-worker. The film was written and directed by Hirokazu Koreeda, adapting a manga by Yoshie Goda. I've seen several of Koreeda's works before, notably the dramas Nobody Knows and Like Father, Like Son, both excellent, so I knew we weren't in for a raucous, raunchy comedy with Air Doll. I wasn't quite expecting where Koreeda would be taking me, though, or how we'd get there. The director doesn't go for the broad strokes, to the point where his dramas can be so restrained that I find it hard to engage emotionally. Here, the film subtly slips between moods, at points portraying a wide-eyed innocent discovering life, a little bit discomforting if you know of the ongoing discussion about Japanese culture's tendency to infantilize its women, but fortunately there's more at work with Air Doll than just that. At other points, going slyly surreal, Koreeda regularly substitutes portions of Duna's actual body with plastic parts, at one moment showing her rinsing out her detachable silicon vagina after the video shop owner blackmails her into having sex, moving into subtly disturbing as the co-worker discovers what Nozomi actually is and takes advantage of that, a reminder of the power dynamic that still exists between men and women, to heartbreaking at the realization that the film's main thesis is the emptiness at the heart of human existence and all the flawed ways we seek to fill ourselves, save for the one that we truly need, contact with others. Koreeda is a master at observing the nuances of humanity, sometimes at the expense of not quite touching us, or at least me, in a way that will give his tales their full impact. Air Doll doesn't suffer from that shortcoming. It's clever, fascinating, and ultimately deeply moving. It took a while to get to the States, but I'm glad it finally made it. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. Don't forget, everybody listening, that WBAI depends on you for support. When we say listener-sponsored radio, it's not like, you know, listener supported. We're not getting lots and lots of government grants or corporate grants or anything like that. You are the sponsor. And it's because of that that we can have things like a science fiction radio show. Now, in its 52nd year, and now in its 52nd year, we're 51 years old as of January. So there you have it. And that is responsible. I wasn't even the first person to be doing science fiction radio here. Baird Searles came before me, and you've heard that before. But the idea is that we're able to do it because of the structure of listener sponsorship. Yeah, there's nobody else who wants a show like this. If ever I would dream of going somewhere else, there wouldn't be another radio station, true radio station, to have me. There might be podcasts and stuff like that, but that's now become a very crowded field. So we'll see about that. But in the meantime, the thing to do is make sure that WBAI, for its radio drama with Max Schmidt and the Golden Age of Radio on Saturday nights, on Sunday nights. It'll be tonight. And WBAI Playhouse on Saturday nights, both at 8 p.m., and all the various programs we bring you, from science shows with Gary Null to, what am I saying, with Michio Kaku, and science programs, if you like, with Gary Null, political programming of many stripes, most of them pointing toward the left. But one way or the other, it's radio that is devised for its listenership, its sponsorship. All radio caters to its sponsors. You are our sponsors. So please, if you aren't already, and even if you are, make a pledge now to be a sponsor. And you can do that by calling area code 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Or visit us online at WBAI.org. A donation of $25 will make you a subscriber, full subscriber to WBAI, with voting rights. We vote for our local board and various things. And it makes you more participatory in what we do here. 209-2950. And the other thing is, consider becoming a WBAI buddy, a BAI buddy. It's more alliterative that way. And that means that you're making a monthly donation. Anything $5 or more is vastly appreciated because it assures us of an income through the year. 209-2950, area code 212-209-2950. Or just go to WBAI.org and take a look at the many opportunities to click on a link that says support WBAI. And by the way, when it asks you, what radio program are you making this pledge in the name of? Well, it's Our Wolf, of course. Now we go back to last Tuesday and continue the event with Lara Elena Donnelly, where she is interviewed by Barbara Krasnoff.
That's it. That's the reading.
Thank you. That was great, and it was a very, very good choice to, you know. Yes, the beginning tells us, drops us in it immediately, but that's a very sort of this, you know, the way that his client has, that's just that little bit of evil, and that just that little bit of I've got more money than you, so I can do anything with you. It really works beautifully.
I love the dynamic between Eisner and Vic, because Eisner's business partners are like born rich, raised rich, old New England money. And you get the sense that Eisner is not quite like them. And so Eisner and Vic really have, they're very similar
in a lot of ways, but Eisner's got the money. And so Vic is like doomed to always be trying to, you know, catch up.
Yeah, Amy Goldschlager says, I think I even know the whiskey bar. Or there was one, yes.
You know, all three trains. I'm sad to hear it closed. I didn't know.
But, so let's talk a little bit about Vic, whose gender is very, very up in the air throughout the book.
Yeah. What about that?
How did you decide to do? Did you decide at the beginning to say I'm going to have a gender neutral protagonist or a protagonist whose gender we do not know?
So when I was writing the short story, I was writing in first person, which is not something I had done much of until that point. Usually, I'd been writing in third. And I realized a couple hundred words into the story, I hadn't given the narrator a pronoun. And I had an image in my head of them. But when I realized I hadn't given them a pronoun, I realized that that image was like pretty mutable and didn't even really feel glued down and that it could change. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of wondered, like, I wonder if I could write this whole story without specifying the narrator's gender, and I could. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool and feels like a wonderful trick that I have played on my readers, because I'm apparently a malicious author. and no one really noticed until I would like point it out to them. And so when I decided to turn it into a novel, I was like, I wonder if I can do it for 100,000 words. And it turned out that I could. And also, like, when I don't want to spoil the book, but the structure of the novel has a formal conceit into which this idea of the gender ambiguous protagonist kind of plays, which is not to say that I'm like, Vic has no gender. I think when you read it, if you're paying close attention, Vic definitely has a gender identity. But it's not something that as a narrator, Vic is like keen to discuss with the reader. Like, it's not something that the book is about. It's very, I think Vic as a person would be like, it's so tiresome that anyone would ask me about this. Like, I've thought about it a lot already and I have no desire to speak to anyone else about it. And it doesn't have any bearing on, you know, what things smell like. Which is actually not entirely true. I've talked to a lot of people about like gender, and especially like people who are going through like medical transition. I've talked to a couple of people about how their sense of smell has changed as they've been taking hormones, and that's really fascinating. So gender and smell can be discussed together as like things that affect each other, but I think Vic is like very over the idea that they might ever have to talk about gender with anyone. Vic never gets a pronoun in the whole novel.
No, and that's I thought was a really interesting thing. It isn't just that you don't know which gender Vic is that you don't even notice. It's not brought out, hey, look, you know, we're gender neutral here. It's not important to the novel.
And I've been very, like, when we were talking about publicity for this book with my publicity team, I had mentioned, like, in the process of acquisition even, like, I had said first to my agent and then to my editor and then to my other editor and then to my publicists, who all said, you know, Vic, he this, he that. And I was like, did you notice Vic never has a pronoun in the whole book? At which point they all went, ah! So my publicists were like, should we say something, like, in our promo material? Should we talk about it? I don't know. And I was like, no, don't mention it at all. I really want to see what people take away. Like, will anyone notice? And I also didn't want it to become like, a book about how this character has like an ambiguous gender. I was like, that's not what it's about. It's a book about capitalism and the hustle and murder. And this is just like another part of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I will say that I didn't notice that, you know, I'm not even sure how I was picturing Vic, but I got about halfway through the novel until when I noticed that that the author didn't tell me who Vic was, and it didn't matter, which was great. Okay, so we have, so Joseph Kennedy says that the sense of smell, that it makes sense. Both my ex and my daughter's sense of smell changed a lot when they were expecting.
Did it become more sensitive? Because what I am hearing so far from people is like, if they like went on testosterone, their sense of smell became less. But if they went on estrogen, their sense of smell became much keener. So I'm curious. I do know that pregnant women often become very, very sensitive to certain smells. So it seems like likely that their sense of smell gets much keener.
And Amy says that John Scalzi has done this a few times, and that his he did two different versions of the audiobook for his novel Locked In, one with a male narrator and one with a female narrator. Simply because the gender of the narrator was not specified, which of course brings up an interesting point. If and when there is an audiobook of the novel, how are you going to handle that?
There is an audiobook, and it is narrated by the absolutely marvelous Avi Roque, who I think narrated Can Spera's latest book. And so when I was trying to figure out what I would do, because I was like, oh, I don't know, I definitely want someone whose voice sounds a very certain way. The person that I was really thinking of is Barbara Rosenblatt, who's like the queen of audiobooks. And I was like, we will never get her. But she has this marvelous, like very deep, husky voice. And like the first time I heard her narrating an audiobook, I was like, is this a man? Is this a woman? I don't care. It's marvelous. So I wanted someone who had that same like deep voice, but with a little bit of vocal fry and sort of like, even if the voice is deep, there's kind of a like higher timbre a little bit, like it a voice that could sort of balance both sides of this. And I had listened to a sample of Kellen's audiobook, and I was like, actually, Avi has exactly this timbre of voice that is like, that sounds masculine, but sort of keyed up a couple of pitches and has a lot of that like throaty fry to it. And it's just perfect. It's just perfect. They did an amazing job. Thank you, Avi, if you're listening.
Oh, I can't wait. Now I have to go listen to it just to hear the voice. And Amy's going to go snag it for herself. So, it's funny too, because once I realized that there was ambiguity there, the first time I said, "Oh, Vic," like in Victor Victoria. So, how did you name the character, because Vic is such an either or name?
Yeah. Because in the short story, the narrator is actually never named. And when I went to write the novel, I was like, I don't think I can sustain that for an entire book. Someone is going to have to say the character's name at some point. I want a name for the character so I know who this person is. And so it had to be a name that could go either way. And I just didn't want it to be Alex. I just didn't want it to be Alex. And actually my partner's mom is named Veronica and goes by Vic for short. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, it could be Victoria. It could be Veronica. It could be Victor. It could just be Vic.
And this is also a very New York novel. I mean, there are so many things about it. It's a New York novel. It's an evil novel. It's about the class, today's class structure. And it's also about the generational, the problems of the current upcoming generation. Are these the kind of things that you want people to, what do you, I should actually rephrase that. What would you like people to come away from with this novel after they've read the novel? Is there anything you'd like them to have realized or gotten from it?
You mean, I think about this well, a lot is maybe an overstatement, but when I think about this book in terms of like, is there supposed to be a lesson, or like, how is this book making the world a better place? I think it's really just an expression of anger. Like, there's no moral here, and there's no like, I want people to take away, like, this is what you can do to like fix this problem. This book is really just an expression of fury, about how unfair everything is. Like, there are a couple of scenes there very early in the book. Vic says to Giovanni, like, it's just not fair. And Giovanni is sort of like, yeah, yeah, I know, I know. But then later, like, Giovanni is the one who's like, yeah, actually, it really isn't fair. You know, we all talk about how, yeah, we all know it isn't fair, but we're all still trying to get by. But I think the book is like, it really makes you stop and look at the fact that things aren't fair and sit mm-hmm. with it and get mad about it and see, like, if you have to live with this unfairness for long enough, and if it affects you deeply enough, you can really get to a very dark place. Hopefully not murder, but you know, I think like Vic is the character who really acts out in a completely insane way. Like, I can't get by, so I'll kill people for money, which is like not something most of us are doing on a weekly or monthly basis. But I think Jane, who is the love interest, yeah. who's the photographer turned bartender turned radiology tech, Jane is like more the character that I think represents the struggle of, you know, millennials and older Gen Z who are just really trying to get by and can't and don't necessarily turn to murder, but might do things like give up on their passion or give up on their dream and say, I just can't do it anymore. I'll be depressed and make a little bit of money instead.
Well, I'm neither of those generations, but I totally understand what you're talking about. I think it's a fairly, although it's about a specific generation, I think it's a very universal feeling, especially among artists who aren't born with money or who do not have a talent for stock. Carrie Hewler writes, I find it so interesting how good you were at identifying scents. All right, how good you are at smelling. I know I don't pay much attention to it other than to think, oh, I can smell that. I don't have COVID. and now you connect gender and smell. Are scents something you've always noticed, as some people notice fashion or color or sound?
You know, it's not something I ever thought about. And I think people don't think about stuff that is really intrinsic to the way that they experience the world, right? So like people who have synesthesia. So one of my mom's friends, we were visiting him and we were talking about Oliver Sacks, right? Who's like, who wrote all of these famous books about, you know, interesting, like neuroatypicalities that he encountered in his work. And he has like a whole essay about synesthesia, which is when you experience one sense or one, like one informational input. So like numbers or music or taste or whatever. You see or hear or experience something and you have a secondary or equal. It's not even secondary. You have like two responses to that stimulus. So people will be like, I hear this music and I taste this taste, or I see this number and I hear this sound. And we were talking about this and her friend gets this look on his face of first sort of like bewilderment and then like dawning sort of confusion. And he's like, wait, that doesn't happen to everyone? Like that I thought that happened to everyone. And we were like, no. And he said, he's a musician. And he said, but when I hear sound, I see color. You're telling me that not everybody does this. And I think that's kind of the case for how everyone experiences like sensory input that's intrinsic to your experience of your life. Like I wouldn't have said, yes, I'm a very keen smeller, but several people upon reading this book have been like, wow, the accuracy and vividness with which like smell is described, especially in the written word, like in fiction, smell gets short shrift, I think. But it's really important. And actually in the research for this book, I learned that people who lose any one of their senses, like if you lose your sense of sight or your sense of hearing, research has shown that your like mental state bounces back much faster. So if you lose your sight in an accident, you're bound to be quite depressed for a little bit, but you adjust much more quickly and can kind of bounce back and like learn to adapt. But they've found in many studies that people who lose their sense of smell become chronically depressed and like incurably many times. They just like all the joy goes out of life. And they adjust way worse than people who lose senses that we think of as like much more critical to living in the world.
Well, that's certainly a little bit depressing, considering that there are a lot of people out there now who are losing their sense of taste and smell. And I've seen some on Twitter and on Facebook, some people describing how, you know, they can't taste anything, and they're afraid because they can't smell if there's gas in the house or anything like that, and it's certainly a fairly frightening prospect.
Yeah, there in one of the books that I read, which is called The Emperor of Scent, which is a book about Luca Turin, who sort of a polymath, who's both like a perfumer and a reviewer of perfumes and a chemist and physicist and like basically does everything. He at one point in the book diagnoses this woman in Scotland who has fallen into a deep depression because everything smells terrible. Everything smells terrible. Just like one day she woke up and everything smelled disgusting and it wouldn't go away. And she was getting to a point where like that she was going to have neurosurgery for them to just basically disable her sense of smell entirely, because she couldn't stand it anymore. She was like, I'd rather smell nothing than this horrible smell. And Luca Turin started corresponding with her and diagnosed her with epilepsy, like a very rare form of epilepsy where she was basically having a constant seizure because it was untreated, right? So she would just have like seizure after seizure, except her seizures took the form of a bad smell.
Wow.
And he said, you should ask your doctor. And like, he of course had like two doctorates or something. He's like an absolute genius. And he was like, talk to your doctor and see if you can get a prescription for this fairly harmless anti-epileptic drug. Like it's an anti-seizure medication. If you don't have epilepsy, it won't hurt you at all. If you do have epilepsy, it will make the bad smell go away. And if they, you know, fight you on it, have them call me. And so she took this pill and it made the bad smell go away immediately. And this also showed that if she had had the neurosurgery to disable her sense of smell, mm-hmm. it would not have cured the epilepsy and she would have kept smelling the bad smell.
That smell.
So like, it was definitely a story that you read and you were like, oh my God, it could happen to me. You know, it's a really terrifying story.
Oh my God. Yes. And Amy Goldschlager says that Sachs also wrote an essay about someone who lost their sense of smell, but was able to evoke it with visual triggers.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've read that one. Definitely going to look for it. His essays are fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Jonathan Gladstone Gelman just says that that it all really draws you in. And the only question he has is what happens next, which is just what you shouldn't answer here. So he's going to go buy the book.
A lot of stuff happens.
Oh, a huge amount of stuff happens. And Amy says, I also have a friend who's never had a sense of smell and she worries she won't be able to tell whether or not she's getting COVID. Although that's not the only way to tell.
Yeah. It has been very strange working on this book in a time where lots of people are losing their sense of smell or are very attuned to it as a way of being like, oh my God, am I getting COVID? I can't smell anything. And also being very worried of, like, wouldn't it be ironic if I was doing, you know, publicity for my book all about smells and I got COVID and lost my sense of smell.
But the interesting thing is you talked about people who smell something and it evokes other senses. And I almost think that Vic is like that because the description, everything that Vic, whenever Vic goes somewhere, they describe things in the sense of what it smells like and all the other underlying smells. And it isn't just that Vic is a perfumier. It's just, this is how they evoke their environment wherever they go, which I thought was absolutely fascinating.
I will cop to when I was writing this, some early readers being like, I thought this character was supposed to be a perfumer. Like, there's no smell in here. So it's definitely something that I had to learn while I was writing, which is funny because I smell everything. Like, whenever I go out into the world, I'm very like, what is that smell? I smell this thing. Do you smell that? I noticed smells a lot, but I was so used to not writing them. Because like I said, smell gets short shrift in fiction. We focus so much on like, what does it look like? Because you have to set your reader into the scene. And the first thing I think we think of is like, where are they? Who mm-hmm. else is there? Mm-hmm. Like, what are they seeing? Because the prose is like the camera. That it took some practice to start writing nose Sense. First.
Yeah. Right. Amy writes, there's a small gallery on Catherine Street that's a scent gallery. They only have scent shows, and they opened during the pandemic.
Whoa, I have never even heard of this. If you remember what they're called, put it in the chat because I would love to go there.
And she mentions, and I agree with her, she thinks New York is full of smells. It's not a good place if you're sensitive to smell. It certainly smells more like weed these days. Well, I think that depends where you are.
I think, though, that depends on your categorization of smells. So, you know, Vic is almost, in a way, like a dog. You know, to a dog, there is no such thing as a bad smell. It's all just information. And I think Vic is kind of the same way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I know that some of Vic's more exotic perfumes are described as in ways where you'd think nobody's going to want to put this on your skin. But it evokes things that it wouldn't if it was just floral or fruit or some fairly not very interesting scent, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, and I mean, it sort of ties back to that the article in The Guardian about the best perfumes having some foul note deep under everything else, where, you know, like one of the things in the opening of the article, Jude Doyle talks about the smell of jasmine, like the flower. This is not even a perfume that a person has made. This is like a naturally occurring scent of jasmine, which I think most people would agree smells beautiful. But the reason that it smells like that is because there is a key molecule in the scent called an indole. And an indole is the same thing that makes excrement smell bad. So like jasmine smells so good because it has just a little bit of filth in it. It smells funky.
Oh my.
Now you know. Now you can never smell a jasmine flower the same way.
Without thinking about that. Yeah, exactly. So why don't I go on and just ask you, are you working on anything now?
Yes. I mean, I'm always working on something. I don't have any like signed contracts or anything, but I'm working on a book that I think is a little bit like a mirror image to Base Notes. It's also set in contemporary New York. I promised my agent that after this, I would not write another New York book, at least not for a little while. But I kind of think of them, I'm starting to think of them as like a little bit of a duology. So this is also about striving millennials in New York City, but it's a very loose retelling of the Ballad of Tam Lin, which since it's the New York Review of Science Fiction, I'm like, I'm sure people probably know, but if you don't know, it's a Scottish ballad about a peppy young lass named Janet who meets a very cute boy and does what girls and boys do when they meet each other. And she gets pregnant. And it turns out that he has been kidnapped by the fairy court and is going to be sacrificed to Satan because they've got a deal where the fairy court has to sacrifice someone to Satan every 7 years or else. So Tamlin, the hot knight, is like, oh, alas, the father of your child, you know, going to be sacrificed to the devil. And Janet is like, not if I can help it. And so she has to rescue him or else, you know, give birth to a natural child. So this is like a very loose retelling of that. But it is about it's about millennials working at a multinational digital media consulting company, which is like our stand in for the evil fairy court. And our hero Sophie has to rescue her best friend Chris, who is in a toxic job at this company.
Oh, I love it.
Magic, maybe, really? Or maybe not.
Oh, you see, now I've just finished that book, and now I'm already waiting for the next one.
I'm afraid you may have to wait quite a while.
Okay, is there anything else that you'd like to sort of tell us about, either what you're working on or about the novel?
Well, the novel is out today. This is launch day. So go out there and get it. Leave a nice review on Amazon or Goodreads. Or leave a terrible review. I found it's very hit or miss. People either really love it or they're like, this was disgusting and upsetting and not in a way that I found interesting or like that I wanted to get further into. Like they hit that opening scene and they're either like, oh, this is my jam, or they're like, so don't feel bad if you are like, you know, we all have our tastes, but obviously I'm someone who's like, this is my jam. I'm going to write a whole book about it.
Well, it certainly reads like that. I mean, it just keeps moving, and it reads like you had such a good time writing it. And I think that's why Vic is such a fascinating protagonist, because on the one hand, they are doing these absolutely awful things, and it gets, and I will tell people, I will spoil a little, it gets worse. But on the other hand, you just want to find out what's going to happen, and you're inside Vic's head the entire time.
Yeah, and it's not a fun place to be. Someone did compare it to Sweeney Todd, and it does get a bit like, this is a fun story. And now, like, the first time I was like, this is a fun story.
Oh, it's very Sweeney Todd. And I love Sweeney Todd, so there it is.
All right, if you like Sweeney Todd, you probably like Bass Notes.
And on that, and on that note, thank you so much. I'm sorry. Just thank you so much, Laura. And once again, we have been speaking to Laura Elena Donnelly, who has just introduced her brand new novel, Bass Notes. There's the cover.
Who, Vanna White?
Which you should absolutely go out and look for it. And go onto Amazon and either buy it there or buy it at a different site and write nice things about it. Or bad things. Thank you very much. And we will be hopefully back. Thank you for coming, as Amy says. And we will hopefully be back next month, probably the first Tuesday of the month. And we will announce our new reader as soon as we can. Thank you so much, everybody, and thank you and thanks to Jim, who is our engineer.
Thank you, Jim
Freund, and Amy Goldfrager, who is our person wrangler.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Oh, I'm so glad. Take care.
You've been listening to Reading an Interview from the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings from last February 1st, conducted on Facebook by Barbara Krasnoff, and the guest was Lara Elena Donnelly, reading from her book, Bass Notes. You have been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Morning Ursae. In the meantime, don't forget to support WBAI by calling 212-209-2950 and making a pledge, or visit us online, WBAI.org. Good morning.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Normally at 8 o'clock, you'd hear Morning Ursae with James Ursae, but that is not on today. He'll be back next week. Instead, you'll hear a special two-hour edition of From the Streets with Bob Law. So please, stay tuned.
This Valentine's Day, you can show love to your mom, your lover, or yourself while supporting WBAI. If you call 212-209-2950 to order flowers, your New York City recipient will receive an arrangement of premium, long-stemmed Ecuadorian Explorer red roses, accented with fragrant eucalyptus and housed in a glass vase. And a portion of your order supports WBAI. To order our Valentine's Day Floral Premium, call 212-209-2950 by the 7th for your true love and for WBAI.
For Building Bridges, I'm Mimi Rosenberg, saying WBAI needs you to step up to keep our press free, to allow its message to radiate out over our signal, and to keep that signal keeping on. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Donate to the Tower Fund at $17,000 per month. We're on a campaign to raise next year's tower rent in full, to pay the basics so we can prepare to build for the future. Pay those essential bills now so we can plan to create additional platforms to broadcast our truth-telling, our content, our messaging, by podcasting, video, digital forms of delivery. So let's pay that $17,000 a month tower rent, $250,000 for the next year, now, to give us a solid foundation, a free press to arm ourselves to beat back the fascist attack, to prepare for empowering ourselves with the knowledge we need to build a democratic society. So whether it's $5,000, $1,000, $500, $100. Dig, give us those dead prez. $5,000, $1,000, $500, $100, or 100 of you right now stepping up to the plate. 100 of you pledging $25 right now. Step up for a free press. Step up and donate to our signal, our tower fund. Donate by calling 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. I'm Mimi Rosenberg for Building Bridges, saying stay strong, stay well, and do the same for our station. Keep it strong. Keep it well.
I love
love New York.
We love New York.
We've been stuck inside our homes
while our everyday heroes have been working overtime
for New York to reopen
and stay open.
We all need to do our part
and show that we care.
Look, man,
I wear a mask to protect you.
You wear a mask to protect me.
Let's all wear a mask
to stop the spread of coronavirus
and save lives.
When we show up in a mask,
we're showing up for each other.
Show your love for New York.
Because New York loves you.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
It is Black History Month. And welcome to From the Streets with Bob Law. We have a really special Black History celebration that we're going to engage in here this morning. Be sure to get your warm beverage. It is freezing cold in the city, and which is perfect radio weather. Just get you some hot beverage and move it a little bit closer to your radio. We're going to celebrate Black History. It's a little bit different approach to celebrating Black History. And observing the wonders of black historical experience in this society. What we're going to look at today is the legacy of gospel music, and kind of walk back through that whole gospel music tradition as it comes out of the black religious experience. And the black religious experience in this country came out of the conditions of black people in this country. So we're going to talk about that, and you might find it really interesting. We've got some great guests who are going to be with us as we move the conversation forward. So moving a little bit closer, and you're invited to be a part of the conversation with me. I'm Bob Law. This is a good day for you to stay indoors. Stay here with me at WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM in the city. And we are going to kind of walk back through a historical analysis, looking at the legacy of our historical experiences. See, I think that if we study history for the purpose of determining how to move forward, which is more significant, I believe, than looking at history to kind of reminisce about ancient achievement and how great we used to be. But I think that there are messages in history that passed along from generation to generation. And as you pass those messages along, if you pass that historical narrative along, there's information in our historical experiences that tell us how to deal with the challenges that confront us here and now, and moving forward with that. We've got some really great guests joining the conversation to help us move this conversation forward is Robert Maravich. Robert Maravich hosts Gospel Memories on Chicago Radio, WLUW, and he is the founder and the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Gospel Music, and he was nominated, and in 2019, he was nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Album Notes for the album The Gospel According to Malico. And there's some interesting stories about Malico. Malico is a record company, and Malico is one of the major record companies in gospel music. And prior to Malico, I think it was Savoy Records. And then came Malico, and the Malico was really a major player. And he was awarded a Grammy for the album notes. We're going to talk a little bit about that as well. And he is also the author of a book called A City Called Heaven, and then Chicago and the Birth of Gospel Music, and then his most current book the book that we're talking about today, Peace Be Still, How James Cleveland and the Angelic Choir Created a Gospel Classic. And so Robert Maravich is joining us in the conversation. Robert Maravich, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Mr. Law. Thank you for having me on the show.
Good to have you with us. A lot of information we're going to be walking through. And also joining the conversation is Reverend Joe Williams. Now, this is a real treat, Joe. Reverend Joe Williams is a member of the original Dixie Hummingbirds. Now, some of you may not be aware of the Dixie Hummingbirds. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let the Dixie Hummingbirds tell you who they are. Come on, Sean.
In the land of the good sunshine, there's a little bird that flies around, humming all the time. And one day in the spring, while the birds were humming, James B. Davis overheard. And then he decided to name his group the Dixie Hummingbirds. So we've been singing from the mountain ever since we went out. We managed to sing every now and then, but most of the time when we would run the surface, we'd always run into Slim. You know, Slim could be the difference in a meal or maybe none. Slim is when you look for 300 people, you don't see for 21. But we've been singing for the master ever since we were in our team.
The Dixie Hummingbirds, indeed. Reverend Joe Williams, welcome to From the Streets with Bob Law. Welcome to WBAI.
Good morning, Mr. Bob Law. You are my idol. I want the people to know the only radio station in Philadelphia years ago at 10 p.m. at night was the Bob Law Show. I think you have a magic voice. You can talk a hungry dog off a meat wagon. Thank you for having me.
My buddy, Reverend Joe Williams, one of the original Dixie Hummingbirds. Now, let me just start here. And then we kind of gonna go back and forth looking at this historical legacy and what it is, what it actually means. Bob Maravich, let me just begin with this book, Peace Be Still, is about a song. Now, when you talk about the significance of the music, a book about a song, a whole book, it kind of suggests that there is something meaningful. There's enough in the song to generate a book. I want to just talk a little bit about that, the decision to do the book and what it is that how it is that this song, Peace Be Still, is deserving of a book.
Right. Well, thank you. Yes. I had never originally intended to write Peace Be Still, but it really came about as part of a dream. And the short story part of that is that I was at the recording session in 1963 in my dream at the recording session of the James Cleveland and Angelic Choir, the First Baptist Church in Nutley, New Jersey, recording Peace Be Still. And I told a friend of mine whose mother was in the Angelic Choir and knew Reverend Roberts at First Baptist and Reverend Cleveland, and she said, you know, you've been called. And I really believe that's true. What struck me about that album and that song was that despite the fact that this was a church choir, they had some recording experience, but they were essentially a church choir with James Cleveland, who was just starting to become a superstar. This album was one of the biggest selling gospel albums prior to Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace. And it just struck me as, why was that so? Was there something about this song, Peace Be Still, that resonated with people? And the issue was that there was a story out there that it really had a lot to do with civil rights. And I I realized immediately upon meeting some of the early members of the Angelic Choir, when Reverend Stephanie Minniti brought them together, they were some of the original members who were on that recording for me to interview, that it wasn't at all about civil rights. It was about human rights, and it was about their daily lives. And it was a way to get through, as you mentioned in your introduction. Peace Be Still was a way to get through the day, the daily indignities of living in a racist society. But it was also just an expectation of hope that despite all that was happening, that there was a God who could ultimately, if he could stop the wind and the waves, he could get rid of your problems too. And and those members really impressed upon me the importance and the significance of that song is almost like a daily affirmation to get through life.
You know, the they say it wasn't about civil rights, it was about human rights. However, most gospel music in that era was about human rights, and the civil rights movement was about human rights. And it was simply called the civil rights movement because of the legislation that it worked for. But it really was about human rights. And this one of the things I want to talk about as we move along is this whole idea of historical memory, historical consciousness, and historical memory. Because, you know, a people, has been said when we examine historical consciousness, that a people, the history of a people exists in spite of their ignorance of it. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that history, that historical memory is passed along is through sermons, songs, folk tales, each generation passing it along, the history of a people, and in spite of or regardless of what the textbooks might say or might not say. And gospel music, it seems to me, was very much a part of that process of passing along the legacy. And the messages in the music, were very much victorious, overcoming oppression. You know, in the late 1800s, the founders and creators of the liberation theology that became known as the Black Social Gospel, that was a powerful narrative that was the driving force, bringing purpose and clarity to the Black freedom movements in this country. And they were very clear about their mission, and they passed those thoughts, those ideas along through sermons. And I think that what gets overlooked, and I wanted both of you to kind of respond to this, what gets overlooked is the role that the music played in passing along not only the tradition, but I guess the traditions that came out of the Black experience in this country. The music